accession number 4617, reel number 3.
Mr. Almond, reel 3. What did the other men think of Lawrence?
Well, he was something of a mystery to us, you know, at that time. I suppose we didn't really know his history. We knew that there was something that he was, something about him, but we didn't know his background, bearing in mind we weren't... We were ordinary tradesmen, just airmen tradesmen, and I suppose not very knowledgeable, really, as far as the outside world of Lawrence was concerned. He was a mysterious figure to us, who had access to the commanding officer, and that in itself used to place him somewhat apart from us. Any airman who was seen in close conversation walking up and down on a quayside with a senior officer naturally would become somewhat suspect amongst his fellow men. I suppose that in itself would tend to cause some reservation.
So none of you had read the Centaurs of Wisdom?
No, I don't think it was written at that time, was it?
I don't know.
I don't believe it was written. It was written later on when he went to India. You see, after he left, what was it? my history is a bit involved. I know that part of it was written when he was up on the frontier, and part of which I visited myself later on. But at that time, I hadn't heard of it, no.
What was his appearance like?
His appearance? A short, squat man with a very strong face and a very strong chin. Possibly, as I remember him... fair-haired, not very tall, somewhat squat, upright, a sort of manner about him which you would tend to respect his opinions and a leader, I suppose, what I'm trying to say, that he had the appearance of a leader, although in spite of his smallness, because of his facial features.
Was he smart?
Oh yes, quite smart, yes, yes, yes. Used to wear the ordinary uniform. There was no special uniform. He wore the ordinary uniform. Often he seemed to be wearing breeches and putties a lot more often than we did.
Why didn't you wear them often?
Well, I don't know. When he left camp, he was always in your... When he left the camp on a Friday, he always went away in breeches and putties, in his best uniform. At that time, we had the button-up tunic with right up to the neck, you know, and the square cap. And breeches and putties. But
weren't the breeches and putties popular with you?
Oh, no, they were very unpopular. It was such a job to tighten, to wind them around. You know, you had, and according to the shape of your calves, if you had, like I have, fairly thin legs, you'd have a job to keep them up, you know, or if you had thick legs, a shorter man, you have pockets underneath each fold, which made them untidy. Lots of boys would buy extra socks and cut the feet off them, and put the leg part of the socks underneath to try to help to give a shape to the things. They were ordinary putties, which shapeless really, and they gradually stretched as they were used, but they were difficult to put on neatly.
You said that you had wooden huts up on the cliff top.
Yeah,
could you give a fuller description of what Mountbatten Camp looked like?
Yes, I have a photo somewhere, but it was a small, opposite the Plymouth Sound, there was the Capwater, which went up towards the small villages of Turnchapel or Reston, and there was the one or two industrial sites where they used to melt down bones because it smelled dreadful, glue factories. And
what do you mean by the Catwater?
This is the actual name of the water, where the inlet comes up. You have the Plymouth Sound. You have it goes over to the looking shorewards. You go off to the left, you go up to Devonport, and looking to the right, there's a Catwater where the Mayflower set sail from, the Pilgrim Fathers. And the Mayflower steps are still there, and we used to have the base opposite in the Catwater, but on the opposite side to the mainland. To go across to Plymouth, we either went by motorboat. There was an old boy called Bill Dunn who used to ply with a motorboat and charge us tuppence each way and take us forwards and backwards. Or you went by your private transport if you had a motorcycle. No one had cars in those days, but quite a lot of boys had motorbikes. There was 5 miles around by road to get into town. So of course we all used the motorboat. And there was a ferry which went to Turnchapel and Oreston, and then called into the camp on its way back to the mainland again. Those are still running now. And in the camp itself there was three large hangar shaped buildings. There were two flying squadrons there. The 204 squadron had the one shed. They had Southampton flying boats. 209 squadron, which had Perth, Blackburn Perth, much bigger three-engined boat. And then the third hangar was occupied for repairs, and one end of it for MT, marine section repairs if they brought one of the boats out for overhaul. The wooden huts were just long wooden huts with one room for an NCO. Opposite that was an ablutions with hand basins and a bath. I think there was two lavatories there as well, and had the iron stoves with the chimney, two of them, which we used to keep black leaded and polished, except in the winter time when you had fires every day, coal fires. They were dirty things, really, very dirty things. And the plain wooden floors with a bit of lino down, brown lino, which we kept polished, and all the utensils, brooms, brushes, handles, scrubbed every day, buckets and galvanized buckets which were polished. The table was scrub table. We had bedside lockers, wooden bedside lockers. These were polished as well. We had webbing equipment which was hung on to two pegs which stood at the top of the bed. This webbing equipment, of course, was all brass fittings, which had to be maintained in a very clean blanket state with, and the brass is polished, and a tin locker which is about 3 foot by 2 foot high with doors on the front. These doors had to be left open, and our spare kit was folded and put in there, and with smooth fronts to the spare shirt, towels, best uniform, and our only private belongings were kept in a wooden box which was underneath the bed. Otherwise everything was made out on open view all the time. The only time you ever locked the locker was when you went away on holiday. And there was an inspection every day by the orderly officer who went around each barrack block, each room, and if anything wasn't up to scratch or on him and bedside locker was untidy, he would make a written note to the, which would be passed to the squadron disciplinary NCO, who would perhaps give you an extra kit inspection or something. We'd have to lay out your kit in your own time and his own time, spare time as well. And on the whole, we were a very smart, tidy lot of people, I suppose.
You said that the type of flying boats were Southamptons. Mm. What did you and the other chaps on the base think to those, that type of plane?
Well, they were a flying boat, and at that time, they were the mainstay of the Royal Air Force flying boats. They were only flying boats. There were squadrons at Felixstowe, Calshot, Plymouth and Pembroke Dock, and all were Southampton flying boats with the exception of the one at Plymouth, number 209, which had Blackburn Perths. There were only four of these Blackburn Perths in the squadron, and there were six Southamptons in the other squadrons. These were metal flying boats, and they'd been made from metal after the wooden design from the First World War. The Southamptons were flying at the end of the First World War, but manufactured from wood in those days.
But did the men on the base think that they were good planes or not?
Well, I suppose we did. We had nothing to compare them with, really. The maximum speed was about 70 knots. That was all. In a good strong gale, you could fly backwards. And yes, I suppose they were acceptable. We had no yardstick to measure them by.
Did they have any faults?
Well, the faults, I suppose, were the slowness. They were suffered from corrosion, which we were always on the watch for. And aluminium was very funny too. They're painted with silver dope, and aluminium corrosion is, of course, a sort of silvery grey colour, so you had to watch carefully for corrosion. You would find it around fittings, mostly around steel fittings which were screwed or riveted onto the hull, and you would find corrosion around them, which all had to be repaired. But they were very sturdy boats. I remember one man, a fellow called Murphy, was a Plymouth man, and on his boat I was absolutely horrified that he found some corrosion around one of the tail struts, and I said to him, "Spud, look at this, you see." And he said, "Oh, shush, don't look at that," and he put some paint over it. He flew in that boat.
Why did he want it covered up?
Because he didn't want to repair it.
Why not?
Well, it was extra work for him, I suppose. He was a man who used to he didn't live on the base. He lived in Plymouth with his family. He was married. He was an older man. He wasn't an apprentice, and one of the older ex carpenter riggers. He was still a carpenter rigger, and he really wanted to get away with his little work as he could do, really. There are people around like that, of course. But it says something for the sturdiness of these boats that it just continued to fly all right.
So what if you discovered any corrosion, how would you deal with it?
Well, if we discovered corrosion, we would cut it out and repair it, rivet patches over it. There was a laid down way in which you had to repair them things, and usually if you found a hole or a corroded portion, you would file it out to a square shape with round corners, and then you would cut out a patch which would fit exactly into that hole, and then you would cut another piece to go inside in the shape of a ring which would overlap the join all the way around, and then an overlapping patch over the whole lot outside, so that in effect you had three thicknesses riveted together on the edges of the hole that you'd cut.
So three thicknesses where there'd only been one before.
Yes. Much stronger, really, than the original construction. But of course, you're adding on a little extra weight, which you didn't really amount to a lot in the overall weight of the whole boat. One of the things which used to cause corrosion was, of course, leakage. Heavy landing on the sea, and you'd spring some of the rivets, and you'd find seepage. Lying in the bilges, seawater lying in the bilges, and that was, of course, very bad as far as a corrosive agent. And we were constantly drying out inside to keep the water out. It wasn't easy to find a where you have sprung rivets. It's not easy to find a leakage that's coming through.
Presumably you had to inspect each plane periodically, did you?
We inspected every time before every day, a daily inspection before it flew. We did a period inspection at every 40 hours of flying, and a major servicing at 120 in those days. Servicing periods right throughout my entire life in the RAF, of course, varied from time to time, and in fact the pattern changed completely, but at that time it was a 40 hour we did a 40, a 40, and a 120, and on the 120 would do a certain amount of dismantling.
When you were doing one of these daily inspections, could you describe exactly how you'd go about it?
Well, there was a schedule. The manufacturers would lay down a schedule of items to be inspected daily. We each had our own task. I was an airframe fitter, or the metal rigger, I'm calling it by its newer name, metal rigger, and my task was to do the whole of the structure. the engine fitter would look after the two engines and the propeller and the radiators. The wireless operator would just look after his own set. And these Southampton flying boats, I don't know if you've ever seen any of them, they were had fabric covered wings, and the wings were wooden, made of wood, the ribs were wood, and covered with fabric, although the metal of the hull was the hull itself was metal. And the two engines were Napier Lion engines, bare engines with no form of streamlining or at all on them, no fairings or engine cowling, just two bare engines, and they were secured to wooden bearers, and in front there were two radiators, big, almost like a car type radiator. We used to use the tropical radiator because the temperate radiator was a smaller one, and the engines used to overheat, so we always used the tropical radiator, which was almost twice the size of the temperate one. And then they were just bare radiators again, set up in front of the engine, and a wooden propeller. Then the daily servicing would be, depending if you're on the water or in a hangar. If they remained on the water overnight, well, of course, you're limited as to your how far you could look around outside of the hull. But assuming you're in the hangar, then you would just walk around the whole of the hull and see if there were any rivet heads that had popped off or any signs of damage. You would check the flying wires to see that they were in a tautness, that they were taut. If there was slack, then it was a sign of strain somewhere. Check the fabric to see that that was intact. And look at your flying controls. On wherever they went round a pulley, you would make sure that there was no fraying. Where they were visible, you couldn't go inside the fuselage, inside the wing, because they were covered in the fabric. The only time that you would inspect those cables would be on the major servicing, when you would strip off the fabric around the pulleys to inspect the cables. They used to fray with fairly quickly, these cables. I suppose each cable would probably last about 80 hours. They never lasted a whole servicing from one to another, not a major servicing. They were fray before then. If you had any doubt as to about to the tension, or if the controls felt sloppy at all, we had a little instrument which we called a tensiometer, which you could check the tension in the cable. There was a laid down figure for each cable according to its size and task it had to do. Check fittings, just look for cracks, strut fittings. I suppose that's about it, really. Yes.
Did you go up in the planes very often yourself, personally?
Oh, yes. Once I became a crew member, then every time that boat flew, I flew with it. Oh, yes. This was one of the perks, shall I say, of becoming a crew member, and why as a junior member on a squadron, you didn't stand a lot of chance. The senior members who'd been there longer, they were the ones who were crew members. And don't bear in mind, of course, there was a shilling a day flying bay, which was a great attraction as well.
What would your duties be in the air?
In the air, nothing. On these particular flying boats, I'm not talking about any other type, just the Southampton. It was, by modern standards, quite a small boat, but I had no task at all in the air. when we were going to fly, I had to make sure that the mooring was prepared, i.e. if we were moored at a buoy, then I would take the steel strop off and would put a, what we term a short slip, that is a short length of rope with an eye at each end, which would just looped around the buoy, so that ready to, when the engines are cast off, when the engines are started, I could just cast off one end of the loop and pull the rope in, and we were free to go away. And when we landed, it was my job to make sure that the we were anchored, we were tied firmly to the buoy before the engines were switched off. And some of the pilots weren't always very good at bringing us up to the buoy. I remember one occasion I fell in. I was reaching out with I had a boat hook, and this boat hook had an eye end which was removed, which would slip off, and there was a rope attached to it. And what one did was you taxi up to the buoy, and then I would slip the boat hook over the strop on the top of the buoy, which the loop, and pull the stick, and it would snap into position, the hook, and we would be secured by the rope then, and then it would switch off engine, and I would pull up, and we would then fasten the steel strop on. Sometimes, if there was a storm, we would take the steel strop off, because if it has been known to tear fitting out of the boot altogether, and by snatching, and we would replace it with a grass rope, replace the steel strop with a grass rope, which would be a 3-inch, practically bigger than that, a 6-inch steel. That was my only task, no task in the air, unless we were going air firing, and then of course I became the front gunner.